Here again, Sir Michael Horden present his favourite selection of poetry and prose in company with Frieda Dye before an invited audience at the Playhouse, Salisbury. With great pleasure. Sir Michael Horden.
As a beauty, I am not a star. There are others more lovely by far. But my face, I don't mind it, because I'm behind it. It's the people in front get the jar. I've always enjoyed, and with great pleasure, the limerick. Perhaps it's because I'm half Irish. Certainly limericks have the sense of inconsequential and ridiculousness that is very Irish. That one, though, is attributed to a late President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson. Here is another, read by my great friend, Frieda Dye.
There was a young man from the Tyne, put his head on the northeastern line, but he died of ennui, for the 5:53 didn't come till 9:15.
So much for the cocktails. Now for the main meal.
This little pig went to market. This little pig stayed at home. This little pig had roast beef. This little pig had none. And this little pig went wee, 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 wee all the way home.
I suppose that's about the earliest memory I have of the pleasure of words. Of necessity, a program in this series must be largely autobiographical. And in compiling this one, I've tried, Pacey, that last quotation, which does contain an element of action, to pinpoint the experience when words of themselves made as much magic for me as the story they told. I think, first, it was when my mother read aloud to her children Kipling's Just So stories. Here's one of them, How the Camel Got His Hump. In the beginning of years, when the world was so new and all, and the animals were just beginning to work for man, there was a camel, and he lived in the middle of a howling desert because he didn't want to work. And besides, he was a howler himself. So he had sticks and thorns and tamarisks and milkweed and prickles, most excruciating idol. And when anybody spoke to him, he said, humph, just humph, and no more. Presently the horse came to him on Monday morning with a saddle on his back and a bit in his mouth and said, Camel, oh camel, come out and trot like the rest of us. Humph, said the camel. And the horse went away and told the man. Presently the dog came to him with a stick in his mouth and said, Camel, oh camel, come and fetch and carry like the rest of us. Humph, said the camel. And the dog went away and told the man. Presently the ox came to him with a yoke on his neck and said, Camel, oh camel, come and plough, like the rest of us. Humph, said the camel. And the ox went away and told the man. At the end of the day, the man called the horse and the dog and the ox together and said, 3:03, I am very sorry for you, with the world so new and all. But that humph thing in the desert can't work, or he would have been here by now. So I'm going to leave him alone, and you must work double time to make up for it. That made the three very angry, with the world so new and all. And they held a palaver and an indaba and a punchayat and a powwow on the edge of the desert, and the camel came, chewing milkweed, most excruciating idol, and laughed at them. Then he said, humph, and went away again. Presently there came along the jinn in charge of all deserts, rolling in a cloud of dust. Jinns always travel that way because it's magic. And he stopped to palaver and powwow with the three. Jinn of all deserts, said the horse, is it right for anyone to be idle with the world so new and all? Certainly not, said the jinn. Well, said the horse, there's a thing in the middle of your howling desert, and he's a howler himself, with a long neck and long legs, and he hasn't done a stroke of work since Monday morning. He won't trot, said the jinn, whistling. That's my camel for all the gold in Arabia. What does he say about it? He says, humph, said the dog, and he won't fetch and carry. Does he say anything else? Only humph, and he won't plough, said the ox. Very good, said the jinn, I'll hump him, if you'll kindly wait a minute. The djinn rolled himself up in his dust cloak and took a bearing across the desert and found the camel, most excruciatingly idle, looking at his own reflection in a pool of water. My long and bubbling friend, said the djinn, what's this I hear of your doing no work with the world so new and all? Humph, said the camel. The djinn sat down with his chin in his hand and began to think a great magic, while the camel looked at his own reflection in the pool of water. You've given the three extra work ever since Monday morning, all on account of your excruciating idleness, said the djinn. And he went on thinking magics with his chin in his hand. Humph, said the camel. I shouldn't say that again if I were you, said the djinn. You might say it once too often, Bubbles. I want you to work. And the camel said, humph, again. But no sooner had he said it than he saw his back, that he was so proud of, puffing up and puffing up into a great big lolloping humph. Do you see that, said the djinn? That's your very own humph that you've brought upon your very own self by not working. Today is Thursday, and you've done no work since Monday when the work began. Now you're going to work. How can I, said the camel, with this humph on my back. That's made a purpose, said the djinn. All because you missed those 3 days. You will be able to work now for 3 days without eating because you can live on your humph. And don't you ever say I never did anything for you. Come out of the desert and go to the three and behave. Humph yourself. And the camel humped himself, humph and all, and went away to join the three. And from that day to this, the camel always wears a humph. We call it a hump now, not to hurt his feelings. But he's never yet caught up with the 3 days that he missed at the beginning of the world, and he has never yet learned how to behave. Did my elder brothers understand Indaba, or Punchayet, or even excruciating? I certainly didn't. But how I loved the words. About that time, too, daily, but especially on Sundays, along with the smell of my mother's muff, that's a word we don't hear nowadays, isn't it? Muff. I remember, our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done in earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive them that trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever and ever. Amen. One of my brothers thought it went Harold be thy name, which puzzled him greatly. At about this time of my life, I was just 5, I caught my first fish. I remember the occasion, honestly, as vividly as if it were yesterday. I was hooked, and have remained devoted, too devoted, to my rod and line ever since.
Upon a river's bank serene, a fisher sat where all was green.
And looked it.
Anon, when light was growing dim, he saw a fish, or else a fish saw him.
And hooked it.
He took with high erected coom the fish, or else the story, home.
And cooked it.
Recording angels round his bed weighed all that he had done and said.
And booked it. A gross slander? Well, perhaps it contains a germ of truth. More books have been written on the sport of fishing than any other. And from Isaac Walton on, and even before, many of a high quality. One that I read over and again is Plunkett Green's Where the Bright Waters Meet. Those bright waters, incidentally, of which he writes, meet only a few miles from here, near Hurstman Priors, the Test and the Bourne. This is the closing paragraph of that delightful book in which, on a return visit to the bourne, he mourns its pollution. And so I say goodbye to her. The watercress beds above the viaduct have scarred her face and marred her beauty forever. The pollard is there still, but the trees with the wild bees are gone. The black death is creeping through the chalk and covering her eyes with a film. Materialism has her in its grasp, and the roadhog must be served. But somewhere, deep down, I have a dim hope that one night the fairy godmother will walk along the tarry road and stop on the bridge and listen, and send a message to me in the dark. And that when the mists begin to lift, and the poplars to shiver, and the cock pheasants crow in the beech woods, the little bourne will wake and open her eyes and find in her bosom again the exiles that she thought were gone for good. The silver trout and the golden gravel and the shrimp and the duns. And smell the dust of the road and see the sun once more and the red and white cows in the grass and the yellow buttercups in the meadow and the blue smoke of the cottages against the black elms of the Andover Hill. And me too, perhaps, kneeling beside her as of old and watching the little iron blue, happy, laughing, come bobbing down to me under the trees below the Beehive Bridge on the Whitchurch Road. And now, the story of Mr. Theodore Castwell, written sometime during the first quarter of this century by a pseudonymous contributor to the Journal of the Flyfishers Club. Heaven is but the vision of fulfilled desire. Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. Mr. Theodore Castwell, having devoted a long, strenuous, and not unenjoyable life to hunting to their doom innumerable salmon, trout, and grayling in many quarters of the globe, and having much credit among his fellows for his many ingenious improvements in rods, flies, and tackle employed for that end, in the fullness of time died and was taken to his own place. St. Peter looked up from a draft balance sheet at the entry of the attendant agent. Gentleman giving the name of Castwell says he's a fisherman, Your Holiness, and has Flyfishers Club London on his card. Mm-hmm, says St. Peter. Fetch me the ledger with his account. St. Peter perused it. Mm-hmm, said St. Peter. Show him in. Mr. Castwell entered cheerfully and offered a cordial right hand to St. Peter. As a brother of the angle, he began, said St. Peter, I'm sure I shall not appeal to you in vain for special consideration in connection with the quarters to be assigned to me here. Said St. Peter, I've been looking at your account from below. Nothing wrong with it, I hope, said Mr. Castwell. Said St. Peter, I've seen worse. What sort of quarters would you like? Well, said Mr. Castwell, do you think you could manage something in the way of a country cottage of the Test Valley type, with modern conveniences, and, say, 3/4 of a mile of one of those pleasant chalk streams, clear as crystal, which proceed from out the throne attached? Why, yes, said St. Peter, I think we can manage that for you. Then what about your gear? You must have left your fly rods and tackle down below. I see you prefer a light split cane of 9 foot or so with appropriate fittings. I will indent upon the works department for what you require, including a supply of flies. I think you'll approve of our dresser's productions. Then you'll want a keeper to attend you. Thanks awfully, Your Holiness, said Mr. Castle. That'll be first rate. To tell you the truth, from the revelations I read, I was inclined to fear that I might be just a teeny weeny, a bit bored in heaven. In her, said St. Peter, checking himself. It was not long before Mr. Castwell found himself alongside an enchantingly beautiful clear chalk stream, some 15 yards wide, swarming with fine trout, feeding greedily. And presently the attendant angel assigned to him had handed him the daintiest, most exquisite light split cane rod conceivable, perfectly balanced with reel and line, with a beautifully damped, tapered cast of incredible fineness and strength, and a box of flies of such marvellous kind as to be almost mistakable for the natural insects they were to simulate. Mr. Castwell scooped up a natural fly from the water, matched it perfectly from the fly box, and knelt down to cast to a rising trout, putting up just under a tussock, 10 yards or so above him. The fly lit like gossamer 6 inches above the last ring, and next moment the rod was making the curve of beauty. Presently, after an exciting battle, the keeper netted out a beauty of about 2.5 pounds. Heavens! Cried Mr. Castwell. This is something like. I'm sure His Holiness will be pleased to hear it, said the keeper. Mr. Castwell prepared to move upstream to the next riser, when he became aware that another trout had taken up the position of that which he had just landed, and was rising. Just look at that, he said, dropping instantaneously to his knee and drawing off some line. A moment later, an accurate fly fell just above the neb of the fish, and instantly Mr. Castwell engaged in battle with another lusty trout. All went well, and presently the landing net received its 2.5 pounds. Very pretty brace, said Mr. Castwell, preparing to move on to the next of the string of busy nebs which he had observed putting up just round the bend. As he approached the tussock, however, he became aware that the place from which he had just extracted so satisfactory a brace was already occupied by another busy feeder. Well, I'm damned, cried Mr. Castwell. Do you see that? Yes, sir, said the keeper. The chance of extracting 3 successive trout from the same spot was too attractive to be foregone, and once more Mr. Castwell knelt down and delivered a perfect cast to the spot. Instantly it was accepted, and battle was joined. All held, and presently a third gleaming trout joined his brethren in the creel. Mr. Castwell turned joyfully to approach the next riser round the bend. Judge, however, is surprised to find that once more the pit beneath the tussock was occupied by a rising trout, apparently much the same size as the others. Heavens! Exclaimed Mr. Castwell. Was there ever anything like it? No, sir, said the keeper. Look here, said he to the keeper. I think I really must give this chap a miss and pass on to the next. Sorry, can't be done, sir. His Holiness wouldn't like it. Well, that's really so, said Mr. Castwell, and knelt reluctantly to his task. Several hours later, he was still casting to the same tussock. How long is this confounded rise going to last? Inquired Mr. Castwell. I suppose it'll stop soon. No, sir, said the keeper. What? Isn't there a slack hour in the afternoon? No afternoon, sir. What? Then what about the evening rise? No evening, sir, said the keeper. Well, I shall knock off now. I must have had about 30 brace from that corner. Beg pardon, sir, but His Holiness wouldn't like that. What? Said Mr. Castwell. Mayn't I even stop at night? No night here, sir, said the keeper. Then do you mean that I've got to go on catching these damn 2.5 pounders at this corner forever and ever? The keeper nodded. Hell, said Mr. Castwell. Yes, said the keeper. Having been an actor for many years, I look back, of course, on so many passages, scenes, speeches that have come my way. Chance illusion or a sudden random thought will serve to trigger off the memory of the pleasure that one or another has given me, and I'll pick the play out of the shelf to read and recall it, if my memory fails to recall it precisely. Of contemporary playwrights for whom I've worked, John Mortimer and Tom Stoppard are on my fairly short list. Here, from John Mortimer's play, What Shall We Tell Caroline, Lily is confiding in her silent and adolescent daughter.
Caroline, they try to tell you things, but what can they tell you We're not men, you see. We're something different. Lots of men don't realize that. All men except... except Tony. I'm a woman, Caroline. And you're going to be one as well. Nothing can stop you. I'm a woman. And what does Arthur call me? He calls me Bin. Bin. When my name is Lily. Now, does Bin sound like a woman's name to you? You know why he calls me Bin? Because he wants me to be his friend, his assistant, his colleague, his thoroughly good chap. To rough it with him on a walking tour through life. He said that to me, Caroline. How can I be a good chap? I wasn't born a chap. My sex gets in the way. That's why he gets so angry. Look, Caroline, do you know why he calls me Bin? Because my father did, and my uncle did, and so did my five brothers, who all married soft-hearted tittering girls in floppy pullovers which came off on them like falling hair, and white peep-toe shoes, and had pet names for their hot water bottles. Those brothers called me Bin. Good old Bin. You can put her on the back of the motorbike. Bin's marvellous. She can go in the dicky because her hair's always in a tangle and her cheeks are like bricks and the wind can't do her any harm. But Babs or Topsy or Melanie, now she has to sit in the front because she's such a fusspot. And so I can change gear next to her baby pink and artificial silk and get her angora all tied up in my Harris tweed. If you take Bin out, it's for great slopping pints. And the other one about the honeymoon couple in the French Hotel. And then you can be sick in the hedge on the way home because Bin's a good chap. We're women, Caroline. They buy us beer when we long to order protection and flattery and excitement and creme de menthe and little bottles of sparkling wine with silver paper tops and... oh, my God. We long to be kept warm. Aren't I right? Isn't that how we feel? Mothers and daughters and wives...
And now, from Tom Stoppard, who gave me a marvellous opportunity to enjoy his wit, his manipulation of the English language in Jumpers, a play in which a professor of moral philosophy struggles to compose and dictate to his secretary a paper on the existence of God, and finds himself now and then in an almighty tangle. No. How does one know what it is one believes when it is so difficult to know what it is one knows? I do not claim to know that God exists. I only claim that he does without my knowing it. And while I claim as much, I do not claim to know as much. Indeed, I cannot know, and God knows I cannot. And yet, I tell you that now and again, not necessarily in the contemplation of rainbows or newborn babes, nor in the extremities of pain or joy, but more probably ambushed by some quite trivial moment. Say the exchange of signals between two long-distance lorry drivers in the black sleet of a god-awful night on the old A1. Then in that dip-flash, dip-flash flash of headlights in the rain that seems to affirm some common ground that is not animal, is not long-distance lorry driving, then I tell you I know. I sound like a joke vicar. New paragraph. There is, in mathematics, a concept known as a limiting curve. That is, the curve defined as the limits of a polygon with an infinite number of sides. For example, if I had never seen a circle and did not know how to draw one, I could nevertheless postulate the existence of circles by thinking of them as regular polygons with numberless edges. So that a 50 pence piece, say, would be a bumpy, imperfect circle which would approach perfection as I kept doubling the number of its sides. At infinity, the result would be the circle which I have never seen and do not know how to draw, but which is logically implied by the existence of polygons. Now and again, not necessarily in the contemplation of polygons or newborn babes, nor in the extremities of pain or joy, but more probably in some quite a trivial moment, it seems to me that life itself is the mundane figure that argues perfection at its limiting curve. And if I doubt it, my ability to doubt, to question, to think, seems to be the curve itself. Cogito ergo Deus est. The fact that I cut such a ludicrous figure in the academic world is largely due to my aptitude for traducing a complex and logical thesis to a mysticism of staggering banality. Well, time's getting on, so for the last few minutes, without apology or order, here are some favourite poems. First, Wordsworth's sonnet. Milton, thou shouldst be living at this hour. England hath need of thee. She is a fen of stagnant waters. Altar, sword, and pen, fireside, the heroic wealth of hall and bower, have forfeited their ancient English dower of inward happiness. We are selfish men. Oh, raise us up, return to us again, and give us manners, virtue, freedom, power. Thy soul was like a star and dwelt apart. Thou hadst a voice whose sound was like the sea, pure as the naked heavens, majestic, free. So didst thou travel on life's common way, in cheerful godliness. And yet thy heart the lowliest duties on herself did lay. Now, another favorite poet, and local to all of us here, in Melchester, Thomas Hardy, at Castle Bottrell. As I drive to the junction of lane and highway and the drizzle bedrenches the wagonette, I look behind the fading byway and see on its slope, now glistening wet, distinctly yet, myself and a girlish form benighted in dry March weather. We climb the road beside a chaise. We had just alighted to ease the sturdy pony's load when he sighed and slowed. What we did as we climbed, and what we talked of, matters not much, nor to what it led, something that life will not be balked of without rude reason till hope is dead and feeling fled. It filled but a minute. But was there ever a time of such quality, since or before, in that hill's story? To one mind, never. Though it has been climbed foot swift, foot sore by thousands more. Primeval rocks form the road's steep border, and much have they faced there, first and last, of the transitory in earth's long order. But what they record in color and cast is that we too passed. And to me, though time's unflinching rigor in mindless rote has ruled from sight the substance now, one phantom figure remains on the slope, as when that night saw us alight. I look and see it there, shrinking, shrinking. I look back at it amid the rain for the very last time, for my sand is sinking, and I shall traverse old love's domain never again. Well, we must have a few more love poems, mustn't we, on the journey. Ginny kissed me when we met, jumping from the chair she sat in. Time, you thief who love to get sweets into your list, put that in. Say I'm weary, say I'm sad. Say that health and wealth have missed me. Say I'm growing old, but add, Ginny kissed me. That was by Leigh Hunt, and now a remarkable poem which is terribly difficult to introduce. It was written by Leo Marx, who during the war worked in intelligence and was responsible for codes. And he wrote this poem for one of those very brave women, Violette Jabot, who was to be dropped behind enemy lines in occupied Europe. It was something to do with the code, and she was so taken with it, she pumped him as to who the author was. He never let her know it was he, and she was killed, still ignorant of the authorship. The life that I have is all that I have, and the life that I have is yours. The love that I have of the life that I have is yours and yours and yours. A sleep I shall have, a rest I shall have, yet death will be but a pause. For the peace of my years in the long green grass will be yours and yours and yours. Now, penultimately, A Prayer Before Birth by Louis MacNeice. I am not yet born. Oh, hear me. Let not the blood-sucking bat or the rat or the stoat or the club-footed ghoul come near me. I am not yet born. Console me. I fear that the human race may with tall walls wall me, with strong drugs dope me, with wise lies lure me, on black racks rack me, in blood baths roll me. I am not yet born. Provide me with water to dandle me, grass to grow for me, trees to talk to me, sky to sing to me, birds and a white light in the back of my mind to guide me. I am not yet born. Forgive me for the sins that in me the world shall commit. My words when they speak me, my thoughts when they think me, my treason engendered by traitors beyond me, my life when they murder by means of my hands, my death when they live me. I am not yet born. Rehearse me in the parts I must play, in the cues I must take. When old men lecture me, bureaucrats hector me, mountains frown at me, lovers laugh at me, the white waves call me to folly, and the desert calls me to doom, and the beggar refuses my gift, and my children curse me. I am not yet born. Oh, hear me. Let not the man who is beast or thinks he is God come near me. I am not yet born. Oh, fill me with strength against those who would freeze my humanity, would dragoon me into a lethal automaton, would make me a cog in a machine, a thing with one face, a thing, and against all those who would dissipate my entirety, would blow me like thistle down hither and thither or hither and thither, like water held in the hands, would spill me. Let them not make me a stone, and let them not spill me. Otherwise, kill me. And lastly, of course, Shakespeare. I don't like reading scenes plucked out of context, inadequately acted, uncostumed. I don't think William would approve either. But I finish with the epilogue from The Tempest. I've had the very great pleasure of playing Prospero in The Tempest on very many occasions. It's thought by some people, as I've no doubt you know, that this epilogue is not only Prospero saying goodbye to his island and the actor saying goodbye to the evening's audience, but Shakespeare's own last farewell to the theatre. So if it's not presumptuous of me, it'll be my farewell to this programme. Now my charms are all o'erthrown, and what strength I have's mine own, which is most faint. Now 'tis true I must be here confined by you, or sent to Naples. Let me not, since I have my dukedom got and pardoned the deceiver, dwell in this bare island by your spell. But release me from my bands with the help of your good hands. Gentle breath of yours my sails must fill, or else my project fails, which was to please. Now I want spirits to enforce, art to enchant, and my ending is despair, unless I be relieved by prayer, which pierces so that it assaults mercy itself, and frees all faults. As you, from crimes, would pardoned be, let your indulgence set me free.
With Great Pleasure was presented by Sir Michael Horden in company with Frieda Dye before an invited audience at the Playhouse, Salisbury. The producer from Bristol was Brian Patton.